It's been almost 3,000 years, and Greek mythology has proved that it is not going anywhere. But it can be difficult to find entertaining and engaging retellings of these myths that aren't fictionalized. Lucky for you, I'm here. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the Greek mythology and ancient history podcast of your dreams. I dive into the convoluted and confusing ancient sources so you don't have to. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is your space to explore mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
The god Ray wept, and the tears from his eyes fell on the ground and turned into a bee. The bee made his honeycomb and busied himself with the flowers of every plant. And so wax was made, and also honey, out of the tears of Ray. Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And that was a beautiful little reading, Robert. What was that?
That quote comes to us from a 1975 translation of a 300 BCE bit of writing. It's essentially cursive hieroglyphs, which is called hieratic writing. Yeah. And more specifically, this wonderful little excerpt comes from a book titled The Tears of Ray, Beekeeping in Ancient Egypt by Gene Kritsky. And at the end of this episode, we're going to chat with the author just a little bit about some of the material we're discussing here and about the book, The Tears of Ray.
This was a very interesting book. Robert and I both read it for this episode, and it covers the relationship between the ancient Egyptians and the honeybee.
Yeah.
The complex economic, religious, and scientific relationship, you might say, going back and forth between them. But we should start, I guess, with Ray, because that's the focus of this little poem segment you read at the beginning.
Yeah. Now, who is Ray?
Ray. You may be more familiar with the name Ra, R-A. The sun god, the creator god of the ancient Egyptians, is often depicted as sort of like a bird's head, the head of a falcon, but also a sun disk that travels across the sky. And then, of course, dusk, it gets eaten and then goes into the underworld. Well, actually, I think those are two different myths, right? It goes into the underworld and then comes back out. But there's another version where Ray gets eaten and then gets rebirthed.
Yeah, and there's a lot of material about he travels across the sky in a solar barge, and then there's a different barge that travels through the underworld at night.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes there are additional gods on those barges. It's very complex.
One of the things I definitely did find out from this book is that these days, if you want to be in line with the academic Egyptology community, you say Ray, not Ray. Ra.
Yeah.
Now, I got Ra from the movie Stargate, where Ra is the bad guy who is essentially an alien version of an Egyptian god.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not it anymore. It's
yeah,
Re.
Yeah. Plus, most Egyptologists dismiss Stargate as a reputable source of,
oh, really?
Of data these days. Yeah. I don't know why. But yeah, this episode, hopefully what we're going to do here is we will allow you to leave the podcast with maybe a little more understanding and respect for the kingdom of the bees and a little more respect and understanding, for the kingdom of ancient Egypt.
Yeah.
Because, there's so much complexity in both. And it's fascinating to sort of look here at this kingdom within a kingdom and how they were related to each other.
Oh, the bee kingdom within the Egyptian
kingdom.
Yeah, because
really
one
is,
that.
Yeah, we have a monarch, a monarchy, within the honeybee, hive.
A lot of workers.
Yeah, a lot of workers toiling away involved in this industry. Mm-hmm. And then, we have this, we have ancient Egypt. We have, another monarchy with a very complex, system of order, a lot of industry going on, a lot of workers, toiling to make it all possible.
And also sort of a two-way cyberbiotic symbiotic relationship.
Yeah. Yeah, indeed.
But I guess we should start with the bee first, because obviously the bee predates ancient Egypt as a civilization, probably not as a landmass. So, Robert, where do bees come from?
Well, I'm glad you asked, Joe. let me tell you about the bees. You'd have to travel back about 100 million, maybe 130 million years, depending on who you're talking to, all the way back to the Cretaceous period.
Okay.
And you'd find
so dinosaurs roamed the earth.
Yeah, yeah, we're going way back here, and you'd find a world rather different than the one we encounter today, devoid of flowering plants and occupied mostly by conifers, which depend on the wind to spread their seeds.
Wow.
Yes.
Can you imagine that? I mean, a world where reproduction depends entirely on the whims of the weather.
Yeah.
Like, can you imagine if animals, because trees can't walk around and find each other to mate. They're stuck in place, trees and bushes, you know, whatever you want. Plants are not very mobile.
Mm-hmm.
So they essentially have to spray their reproductive material into the air, just hoping it gets somewhere worthwhile by chance.
Yeah, indeed. This is just an earlier state in the evolution of seed transfer. So there are no flowers and there's certainly no pollination. Now, there were no bees at this point, but there were wasps. And
okay.
These wasps were also kind of different from the wasps that we encounter today.
But they were Hymenoptera, the order that wasps and bees are in.
Yeah, indeed. They were carnivorous. They preyed on spiders and other insects, and many of which in turn fed on vegetation. So we have a traffic going on here. All right. Seeds are going into the air. The wasps are eating the insects that live on the plants. But plant evolution eventually begins to make the most out of this constant insect traffic, using it like the wind to carry genetic material from plant to plant. And this results in the rise of angiosperms. These are plants that depend on insects to spread genetic material and pollen from male plant parts called anthers to female parts called stigmas.
This is one of those moments I often want to say, like, oh, how smart that is.
But, I know. It's,
you know, it's like as if somebody planned it. Now, of course, it wasn't. These are just the wonderful ingenuities of evolution acting upon the environment. But
yeah,
it's fascinating how things like this come about. So you have to imagine a system where these plants are pollinating by wind, but they have this sperm, the pollination material, I guess you would say pollen, and somehow insects start getting this stuff on their bodies.
Right. Essentially, a new wind emerges, and that wind is the movement of these insects.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, once that works out for long enough, plants sort of evolve traits to specialize in that mode of transmission. It's no longer an accident. It's how they work now.
And indeed, you see the emergence of delicious nectar to sweeten the deal for the pollen-carrying insects, saying, hey, come here, get all nice and covered in pollen-y. And I'm totally anthropomorphizing the entire process here. My apologies. But yeah, essentially bribing the insects with the delicious nectar to get them to carry the pollen, giving them a specific reason to traffic the parts of the plant where pollen is produced.
So I can imagine if you're some wasp 135, 130 million years ago and you've been hunting insects, that's tough work. You know, it's really tough. Now, if you could just start getting all of your meals from a passive plant that will sit there and let you just lap up delicious, sweet things from its open maw. That, I mean, what a nice deal.
Yeah, yeah. Suddenly there's this wonderful new way to get the food you need. Now, granted, they're still tied to their predatory past. And indeed today, you can look at most common wasps and they're depending upon nectar as their primary food, but they still have to turn to their carnivorous ways, when it comes to rearing their young, implanting their young in the belly of another, creature.
Oh, the parasitoid wasps.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah. Which is just a wonderful area, that we have explored in past podcasts and I'm sure we'll return in the future.
Christian and I talked about it in our X-Files episode.
Oh, yes, of course. Yeah, that parasitoid wasps are, not only is it just an endlessly fascinating area, but we just get new studies each year with either a new type of parasitoid wasp or some new details about a species we are already familiar with.
Yeah, so the wasps evolved to live off of what is provided by the plants. And in an interesting way, I think we could think about this as the plants domesticating livestock.
Yeah.
The plants have domesticated the livestock of insects in order to do their bidding.
And of course, the wasps are one thing, but it's the bees where we really see this take off. Because of course, bees evolve from wasps. They're all related. But the bees are actually, they're gathering the nectar. They're bringing it back for their young. They're creating honey. They're creating these waxy nests. They are completely beholden to the nectar. They're no longer going out and specifically killing other creatures to rear their young.
Okay, so when we're talking about honeybees, true honeybees, this is the genus Apis, right?
Yes, and that's why we also refer to it as apiculture.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Yeah,
beekeeping is apiculture, mm-hmm. Not the keeping of apes.
Right.
A fun fact to remember, by the way, next time you're adding a dab of honey to your Earl Grey tea, mm-hmm. is that honey is bee barf, right?
Yeah.
This is how honey is produced. It's produced by bees grabbing some sweet nectar, which is pretty much sugar water,
right,
from plants, and then going through a complex process of regurgitation and evaporation.
Yeah, so they're kind of distilling it, refining it through their just regurgitation of the material. You know, and I should also mention that when it comes to bees, we have bumblebees, we have stingless bees, and we even have a few other non-bee species that produce honey in small amounts. But for the most part, we're dealing with those Apis honeybees, which are the superstars, the generators of like a true bounty, an excess of honey, in the amount that it makes sense for humans to raise them and pillage their stores.
Now, when I was a kid, I used to wonder, we eat honey, but I know bees make honey. I did not know that they barfed honey up for us, but I didn't know that they made honey, but I didn't know what they did with it. I was like, why do they make it? Is it just, what is it? What's it for? Did the bees themselves eat the honey?
Yeah, they store it as a primary food source. They also eat what is called bee bread. Which is, essentially
a very cute name.
Yeah. It's essentially like a pollen cake, you know, but yeah, the honey is a food source for the bee people, if you will. And they store it away in those, waxy cells, in the honeycomb.
But you mentioned wax. Of course, wax is another important byproduct of bee culture. It's their second great, technology.
Yes, indeed. And the wax that the workers actually secrete from specialized glands on the underside of their abdomens.
Wait, what? They secrete it?
Yeah, essentially, you know, you can think of them as like wax nipples, I guess.
So the bees have wax nipples and mm-hmm. they put out the wax, what is this little flaky lipids for us?
Yeah, and they get the raw materials for this metabolized product through the consumption of that honey and that bee bread, which we already mentioned. And the bee bread, I should also have pointed out that it's essentially collected fermented pollen. So
yeah.
So these serve as it kind of goes around in a circle, right? The nectar, the honey, the wax. This whole little city for the insects built from the bounty of the flowers.
Yeah. Now, long before humans started formalized apiculture, before they started making beehives to keep bees in to mm-hmm. sort of have an agriculture of insects, hunted honey, right? There was wild honey hunting, the same way you would hunt game in the forest or on the savannah. You could hunt honey just as it occurred in a beehive that might be hanging from a tree. And there are actually ancient works of cave art that depict this.
Yeah, there are still also honey hunting traditions that survive to this day. And it's essentially the same thing a bear does, right? If a bear breaks into a honey hive, or a honey badger goes after some bees as well.
Yeah.
You find out where the hive is, you locate it, and then you use the best skills at your disposal to break in there and get as much dripping honeycomb as possible and run off with it.
Now, Kritsky's book has an illustration, or not an illustration, it does have an illustration, but also a photo of this great cave painting from Spain that mm-hmm. seems to depict honey hunting from how old is this thing?
Yeah, this dates back 7,000 to 8,000 years. So that gives us a rough estimate of not where it began, but at least how far it probably goes.
Yeah. And so what's depicted in the painting is this great setup. It looks like a scene from a movie mm-hmm. where you've got somebody hanging from a rope, apparently off a cliff, being lowered down to an area where there's a tree with a bee's nest hanging off of it and reaching in to grab the honey. And you can see bees swarming around the person. I mean, that's a lot of trust in whoever's holding the rope, right?
Yeah. And, and you know, you're just getting just the bejesus stung out of you the whole time, but it's just such, I mean, especially in a,
the energy density of that
score. I mean, this stuff is just, is pure gold, nutritionally speaking. So you're going to occasionally do what it takes, to get it and bring it back. Not to mention the value you're going to have bringing that stuff back to your community.
But I guess we should now look at when true apiculture started. When did we start having beehives that, where we sort of set up an enclosure and said, bees, go live in there. Here's where you should make your homes. And they obeyed.
All right. So as best we can tell, beekeeping probably emerged by accident, probably in the Fertile Crescent. And probably what you had happen was you have human industry is creating all of these different pots and containers, mm-hmm. For your various, agricultural efforts.
Right.
And, one might leave a pot hanging around somewhere unused. Suddenly some bees come in. They take up a residence in the pot. And this could theoretically serve as like the first accidental beehive that's actually kept by beekeepers, and they realize, oh, bees will actually build their nest in this spot. If I leave it out for them, there's a chance I'll have my own captive honey hive.
Yeah, I mean, talk about turning a loss into a win. So imagine, you know, you've got this jar that you were planning on keeping full of ergot-infested rye, and you go back to get it, and suddenly it's full of bees, and you're like, oh man. My plans are spoiled. I'm going to get stung cleaning this thing out. But then you realize you have access to all this sweet, sweet honey.
Yeah. And not only the honey, but the wax. The wax is key because there is evidence of lost wax castings dating back to 3500 BCE. Now, a lost wax casting, for anyone not familiar, this has to do with a cast used to make like a metal objects mm-hmm. in which it's you build like the clay or what have you around a wax model of the thing you're going to build, and then you melt the wax out of there, and voila, you have this mold
mm-hmm. which you can use to make metal objects.
Right.
It's a way of turning easily moldable wax into metal.
Yes,
which is pretty awesome.
Yeah. So the only thing here is that you don't have to be a beekeeper to get that wax. That wax could have been obtained through honey hunting. We just don't know. But when it comes to actually finding the earliest evidence of bee raising, of beekeeping, then you really have to go to the Egyptians, to the ancient Egyptians. And this would put us around 3000 BCE.
That's 5000 years ago.
Yeah.
I mean, it's amazing just to consider, completely separate from the topic of beekeeping, how enormously long ancient Egypt went on.
Yeah, we're talking roughly, 5,000 years of human history wound up in the ancient Egyptians. A a civilization that after it, you know, even when it was going, it was an ancient civilization. And of course, it's impossible for us to summarize, you know, thousands of years of ancient history, the ebb and flow of political and social change here. You know, in the same way that Egyptian history is tied closely to the Nile, so too is the region's history a long, twisting, swelling, shrinking movement across the landscape of human history. But to summarize, we're talking the civilization of ancient North Africa, generally attributed to lasting from roughly 3100 BCE to 322 CE.
So that's talking about the transition out of the Stone Age, out of the Neolithic
right.
period, the beginning of large-scale civilization in ancient Egypt, until the time, I think they mark the end of it, with the time that the last hieroglyphic carvings were made in Egypt.
Yes.
And that's the one in 300-something CE.
Correct. Now, you can also, some historians and authors, including Gene Kritsky, also go ahead and include that Neolithic period. And that would put the beginning around 5500 BCE. So that's where you would get a total time period of around 5,163 years. Of culture.
Yeah. So for those of you who think it's been forever since the American Revolution or something like that, it is such a tiny blip.
Yeah,
modern history is such a tiny blip in human civilization.
It really dwarfs the modern age. So, you know, that's essentially the time period we're talking about. And during that time, the ancient Egyptians demonstrated their expertise of a number of general and highly specialized categories and skills. They were accomplished farmers and engineers. They were artists and linguists. They were soldiers. They were astrologers. They were doctors and much more. I mean, everyone knows about the pyramids and various architectural marvels that survived to this day. Everyone knows about the rich history of mummification, which we've talked about here on the show before. But other stuff just continually fascinates me when I read about it. For instance, to find out that ancient Egyptians performed surgical skin grafts as early as 800 BCE. Indeed, as we're discussing in this episode, that they practice the earliest known examples of apiculture.
Okay, well, once Egyptian civilization is underway, once we've got our dynasties and our organized hierarchical civilization and culture, we should look at the role bees and honey played in that. And one of the first things I think we can observe is that there is a glyph in the ancient Egyptian hieroglyphic language. It's one of their symbols that's a honeybee.
That's right, yeah. It shows up in some of the earliest examples of ancient Egyptian writing. In fact, we see it in use by the Old Kingdom. That's 2687 through 2191 BCE.
And we probably shouldn't try to get too much into talking about the different ages of ancient
right.
Egypt, but essentially there's an Old Kingdom that goes on for a long time with many pharaonic dynasties, and mm-hmm. then there's an intermediate period that's sort of like a dark age, and then there is a Middle Kingdom, and then there's another break in that. There's another intermediate period, and then there's a new kingdom, and then of course there's the Greco-Roman period.
Right.
And,
but essentially
coming into the Middle Ages.
Yeah. But essentially at this point, just think of this, the Great Pyramid and the Sphinx are there. They're relatively newly constructed, and there's evidence already that the Egyptians had at that point mastered to some degree beekeeping and were producing honey.
Okay.
Yeah, according to Kritsky here, there's evidence from around this point that you actually had a role in the governmental structure known as the sealer of honey. There was an individual who was the sealer of honey, and this at least suggests either very organized honey hunting or quite possibly the beginnings of industrialized beekeeping.
You know, I love this title that you see throughout ancient Egypt, the sealer.
Yeah.
The person who seals. And that imbues an authority.
Yeah, it reminds me a lot of our recent episode on the Inca. And we talked about the importance within a government, with importance within an empire of having a way to, of course, record you know, amounts, when it comes to goods, the price of goods, the exchange of goods, and then also being able to seal it and say, this is what is contained within, and someone is accountable for it.
Yeah. It's a very wonderful, physical metaphor for having the final word on something.
Yeah.
But so we do see in ancient Egypt the evidence of the first organized beekeeping, right?
Yeah, the current earliest known evidence takes us to around 2513 BCE, and specifically it takes us to the solar temple Shezabibrit. So what we have here within the ruins of this solar temple, that's again, it's devoted to Re, we see decorative colored reliefs that show off scenes of desert wildlife, boating, and beekeeping.
Yeah, and it's got these different vignettes that actually show the stage. I mean, it's not just sort of like a cartoon, like, oh, here are some people beekeeping. It's sort of comprehensive. It shows the different steps you take in order to do the main jobs of a beekeeper.
Yeah, and there's a certain amount of interpretation that has to take place in figuring out exactly what they're showing and exactly what those vignettes are showing.
Especially because some parts of it are missing.
Yeah, some parts are missing and or damaged, and depending on what's going on there, you know, that ends up impacting our understanding of exactly how advanced they were. So, for instance, one of the vignettes in particular represents a man either using a smoker to control the bees, or he's calling a queen to enter a jug.
Now, either one of those options is very interesting, and we should talk about what that actually means to smoke the bees or to call the queen.
Yeah, the smoking thing, I think most people are familiar with this because if you've seen any footage or even in the course of your life, if you've seen beekeeping, you've probably seen people using a smoker.
Yeah.
Because the smoke calms the bees.
That's a nice way of putting it.
Yeah, it's a weapon you get to use against the bees so you can pillage their goods.
It's like saying tear gas calms the crowd.
Yeah, but it works. And when you try and figure out exactly how this came about, you know, who knows? Somebody was getting stung by bees and they leveled their torch at them and they noticed the smoke helped. Or perhaps one was making a burnt offering and they found that the smoke from the incense calmed the bees. You know, there are a couple of different ends there.
Mm-hmm. Now, the calling is also a fascinating possibility, whichever one he's doing here. If he's calling, it seems to be that he's got a beehive up to his face and he's making sounds with his mouth into the beehive to get the bees to do something, which is just amazing. Now, how exactly would this work? What would he be doing?
Well, it's known as piping, and it's a very real thing, and it's also still practiced in some beekeeping traditions, especially in Egypt to this day. Like even despite all that has fallen away from ancient Egypt and modern Egyptian culture, you still see some of these traditional beekeeping practices that are utilized there. So essentially what's happening here is a beekeeper mimics the queen's audible communication. So the queen is pushing her thorax against the honeycomb and vibrating her wing muscles without moving her wings. And it creates this, it's a long tone followed by a series of short bursts. And I've heard it described as zeep, zeep, zeep.
There's also a cack, cack. Tone,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there are different tones that the bees make to one another to communicate, to signal, essentially what they need to do in the next stage of a reproductive process. Like if a young queen is within the nest.
Right. And specifically here, my understanding is that what the bee caller is doing is creating the sound of an emergent virgin queen.
Yes.
And then that would cause the existing monarch or another emergent queen to come forward and fight her and try to kill her.
Yeah. Calling her out.
Yeah, calling her out. So you're manipulating the bees, speaking their language in order to draw the queen away so that you can put her in a bottle, move her to another hive, and use her presence to manipulate the your creation of new hives or just moving the existing hive.
Yeah, so just the idea of a human being able to make bee sounds, to talk to the bees, is fascinating on its own. Also, that they figured this out in ancient Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
But there are other techniques displayed at Nusairi Eni's solar temple as well, right?
Yeah, there's another vignette that seems like it shows a man pouring something from a spout. So this might be honey taken from the hive.
Uh-huh.
It might be honey that's just separated from the wax. They might be diluting it.
You mean diluting the honey with water.
Yeah, diluting the honey with water. And I remember reading in Krinsky's book that some have commented on this and thought, well, maybe they were making mead or something. Because you can, of course, take honey and create an alcoholic beverage from it. But there's apparently no real evidence that that's what was actually taking place here. Yeah. Though they apparently did add honey, perhaps in diluted form, to their alcohol.
Yeah. So they sweetened wine or beer with it, but they didn't make mead as far as we know.
As far as we know, yeah.
Now, looking at these vignettes, I wanted to observe something that struck me as quite strange. Throughout this book, and so meaning throughout ancient Egypt, there are lots of pictures of bees. I mean, this makes sense because we have this bee glyph, this standard bee illustration that's part of the hieroglyphic language, the written language system. But there are also all these illustrations of bees that appear in vignettes and carvings throughout ancient Egypt, depicting a swarm of bees or a bee next to a jar showing that the jar has honey in it, or in these beekeeping scenes. And I noticed very often it looks to me like these bees do not have a correct number of legs.
Indeed, yeah.
I feel like I don't want to be pedantic here, but often you see the bees with four legs, or you see them with three legs. I can understand the three legs because we know insects have six legs. Mm-hmm. The three legs, maybe you're just seeing one side of the bee, so each leg stands for a pair. But the ones where it shows four legs, or maybe five legs, like four forward legs and one back leg sticking out, those are strange to me, especially since there's like no animal on earth that has an odd number of legs. But anyway, this four-legged ancient bee it rang a bell vaguely in the back of my mind. Mm-hmm. I was like, where do I know that concept from before? And it was saying to me, go back to Sunday school. So I did. I checked it out. I looked in the Bible and bingo, in the Bible, in the Hebrew Bible, in Leviticus 11:20-23, we read about four-legged insects in a part of the ancient Hebrew dietary restriction. So I just want to read this selection of Leviticus from the New American Standard Translation.
This is referring to which insects are kosher, right?
Yeah, which you can and can't eat. Mm-hmm. And so the translation reads like this. All the winged insects that walk on all fours are detestable to you. Yet these you may eat among the winged insects which walk on all fours, those which have above their feet jointed legs with which to jump on the earth. These of them you may eat, the locust and its kinds, and the devastating locust and its kinds, and the cricket and its kinds, and the grasshopper and its kinds. But all other winged insects which are four-footed are detestable to you. Now, obviously, I'm not trying to like hammer these ancient people like, oh, what a bunch of dummies. I mean, they weren't dummies. You wouldn't expect either the ancient Egyptian artist who created the solar temple carving or any of these other carvings and illustrations, nor would you expect the Jewish author who wrote this part of Leviticus to be some kind of entomologist studying bees up close and locusts to see how many legs they have.
Right. There's a division in Egyptian society, and the individuals who are keeping the bees are probably separate from those that are actually carving the hieroglyphics.
Yeah. So I'm certainly not saying that they're stupid. They should have known better. But it just did seem like an interesting coincidence that multiple ancient peoples would get this wrong. And also, as I kept reading in the book, I came across more art that depicted bees this way, is on this Old Kingdom seal amulet, on a Middle Kingdom scarab carving. And so it just made me wonder, is there a widespread belief in the ancient Near East that insects had four legs?
Hmm. Well, you know, after you brought this to my attention, I was looking around a little about it. And certainly there's a lot of just pointless information out there with people either using this as an argument against religion and against the Bible, saying, "Hey, they got the number of legs on a grasshopper long. How can you trust anything in this book?"
Yeah, that sounds it.
Yeah, I read in Food and Culture, a reader by Carol Cunahan and Penny Van Estrick, that possibly the biblical distinction here is more about insects that walk versus those that fly, or at least kind of have that live in that area between true flight and walking.
So in that case, it would be saying something like the saying having four legs or going on all fours, which the Bible passage says and which these bee images indicate. It's not really about counting the number of legs. It's more just kind of like this is in the category of things that crawl.
Right, that it's a land animal and that...
But bees fly.
Bees fly, so they're okay. So it's more like saying don't eat the insect land animals. But then another thing that comes to mind here is just the law of conservation of detail, which is the reason that everybody on The Simpsons only have four digits on each hand, and why you do see a number of bees and other insects in cartoons that have the wrong number of limbs.
Yeah.
Because ultimately, when you're recreating these things on a smaller, unreal scale, you are forced to use an inaccurate number of limbs or digits.
Oh, well, that seems like a very logical explanation to me, especially for the illustrations of the bees.
Yeah. And certainly worth remembering for future alien civilizations that come to our planet and try and figure out The Simpsons. What are they trying to tell us? What is with the fingers? So, first of all, it's interesting to just, discuss the importance of honey as a trade good.
Yeah.
I was really fascinated by this, cause as Kritsky points out, Egyptian society didn't really have a currency.
I mean, they sort of did, but they didn't have a physical currency.
Right.
They had an ideal currency.
Yeah.
Which they would use to, essentially the way it worked is you had a measure of a certain metal, like copper, and then you would have certain quantities of that copper, but you wouldn't actually hold the copper in your hand. So if you were owed, for example, 5 debens of copper, you would be paid 5 debens of copper worth of grain or something like that.
Yeah. And there would also be cases where if you were supposed to pay or be paid in grain and they did not have the grain, you might pay in honey.
Right.
So honey, in a sense, was a currency.
Yeah. But it was valuable from what I understand.
Yeah, and like that value would go up and down, but it was a valuable commodity.
It wasn't something that everybody be eating all the time. It was sort of a luxury food item.
Yeah, a luxury food item, as well as we'll discuss an item that is utilized in medicine and magic.
So you're saying honey was money.
Yeah, honey was money. And since honey was money, honey was of course also an industry, a state-run industry. The ancient Egyptians were a civil organization, and that's how they built their wonders. That's how they made their honey. They had a system of beekeepers, overseers to look over those overseers. They just a whole, system, to regulate the production of honey and then ultimately the trade of honey with other cultures.
But of course, the honey also had a great spiritual significance within Egyptian religion and their priesthood and their mythology, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we already talked about the tears of Re. The bee is the tear of Re. You know, the sun god cries and his tears become a gift to us that gives us this sweet, sweet food.
Yeah. It is the product of a holy animal to the ancient Egyptians. And certainly, too, I mean, it's golden. It glistens. When the sunlight hits it, it appears to glow. You can easily imagine just carrying a little of your symbolic, magical understanding of the world into your contemplation of honey. It's this potent, perfect thing.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use this directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Mother's Day is coming, and Mom doesn't want flowers. She wants a cocktail. Here's a hint. Get mom Bartesian. It's the countertop cocktail maker that creates your choice of over 60 premium cocktails in less than 30 seconds, each at the touch of a button. Flowers die. Happy hour comes back every day. So get mom the machine that makes amazing cocktails with real fruit juices and craft bitters. Best of all, get $50 off a Bartesian premium cocktail maker with the purchase of one pack of cocktail capsules. So, instead of getting mom a reason to fill a flower vase with water, get mom the easiest, fastest way to fill her glass with the floral notes of gin. The best cocktails are premium cocktails, and the best day to get it for mom is Mother's Day. Because you can get $50 off now for a limited time. Visit bartesian.com/mother to get the best premium cocktail maker for mom at the best price for you. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
Western nations like the U.S. and Europe.
Mexico will likely have its first female president.
And then you have China.
And help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters.
He'll get his yo-yos to Europe in time. But the longer this drags on, the more worry he's getting.
They knew that they needed to do this as fast as they possibly could to get a drug on the market as fast as they could.
I'm David Gura.
I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen. We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets.
Basically, everyone was expecting, if not a calamity, certainly a recession.
But the problem is that that paperwork, as our reporting showed, is fake.
As someone who's covering the market, I'm often very worried about an imminent collapse. So I'm thinking about it quite often.
Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, of course, in the ancient world, we often see an association between healing and religious ritual. It's very likely in an ancient culture that you might find the medicines and the doctors sort of overlapping with the priesthood and the sacred rites. There wasn't always so much of a distinction between science-based medicine and magic-based medicine. And you certainly see that come through with honey, because honey actually does have known medical uses that are truly effective. It was also used as a sort of functional medicine, but also as a magical medicine in ancient Egypt.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, we're in a situation where, the best minds are using the materials at hand to try and treat injuries and disease. Some of it is working. Some of it is sort of working. Some of it's not working, but maybe it seems to work. And some of it just feels right within the framework of their worldview. So it's interesting that Egyptian physicians, who were at the time were considered some of the best in the world. Like, this was, again, in ancient Egypt, you found skin grafts taking place.
Yeah.
So an Egyptian physician would treat a wound, but they would also give you a wax amulet to burn. And this is key because you take the wax, all right? You make a candle from the wax or just this amulet. And when it burns up brightly and it burns up completely. So symbolically and by extension, magically, it consumes the illness.
Yeah. Burning completely, meaning there's no ash left.
Right.
No ash at all. I mean, so there's this almost magical quality to that. You'd expect ash from all of the other burning you do in your normal life. I mean, We all burn a lot of things, but there's always some evidence left behind. If you can burn this wax figurine up completely, something does seem very otherworldly about that.
Yeah. And you burn it, you burn this thing that is made from this substance that comes from the creature that in turn came from the god of the sun.
Now, speaking of the sacred or religious aspects, I couldn't, pardon me this indulgence, but I could not help but notice that sort of understanding the science behind the emergence of beekeeping is to see the biological evolution of a trinity between three organisms. So you've got your autotrophs, your pollinators, and your domesticators. The autotrophs are the plants. You know, these are the creators of the energy in this chain, and they create nectar from sunlight. So they turn the sunlight photo energy into sugar. Then the pollinators, the bees, in a way are sort of the redeemers. They convert this, this scant nectar that the plants produce through a process of sacred barfing into very highly concentrated and prized valuable honey. And then, of course, the domesticators, which are the human beekeepers, are, I would think of them sort of as like the order, the logos that holds this whole system in place. And in biological terms, it's a three-way symbiosis. It's three ways that organisms are all interacting and all benefiting from the system. And in terms of the religious context, you've got this trinity. And I was just trying to think of other cases in the natural world where we see domestication taking this form of a three-way symbiosis. I mean, obviously, like grass converts sunlight into chemical energy, and then our cattle eat that. But I don't know if you'd say that's symbiotic for the grass. Like, does the grass benefit from being eaten by cattle in the same way that the plants benefit from being pollinated by the bees?
Yeah, I was trying to think of any other examples earlier. And, you know, I think you can sort of stretch it and apply it to other organisms, but it's hard to think of an example where it applies so perfectly. And so, you know, just so, you know, symbolically.
But anyway, let's get back to beeswax and some ancient apicultural voodoo.
Okay. Yeah. So they're using beeswax for a number of things, not just magical. They're using it as an adhesive. They're using it as an embalming agent, a light source in the form of candles, an artistic medium. But magic is where it really shines. So it's malleable. It doesn't break down in water. It doesn't discolor unless you put it out in the sun. And that actually makes it work perfectly within their magical thinking, right? Because the rays of Ray will actually change the color of the sacred sculpture. And it also doesn't lose its shape after being molded into its desired form. So you have wax figures that last for centuries when they are actually stored away. One of the problems here is that since so many of these wax figures from the Egyptians, they were made to burn. So yeah, a lot of them were burned.
Right.
So, you know, you find some in tombs here and there, but certainly the vast majority of the amulets and statuettes that were created were consumed by fire.
It's the same reason that future generations of archaeologists aren't going to find all that many intact piñatas to study from our culture.
Exactly. So there are a few different accounts that Kritsky rolls through that help help us understand the use of these wax magical icons. So the Salt 825 papyrus, that's the one that original quote was from, about the tears of Ray.
Okay.
It describes how wax, quote, could be used to ensure the destruction of Seth, the god of confusion, disorder, and violence, and the murderer of Osiris, unquote. So simply, you'd make a beeswax likeness of your enemy, and then you burn them to, quote, kill the name of Seth.
That is too cool.
Yeah, I mean, it's like I said, essentially a voodoo doll.
I want to do that right now. Yeah, this principle is just too good. And it doesn't just work for destruction. It can work multiple ways. You might say the wax magic goes, it's a two-way street.
Yeah.
Cause there's one great story in the Tears of Ray also that recounts the, a 12th dynasty myth of a priest named Webaunar, not Webinar, but Webaunar.
Yeah, I kept reading it in my head as Webinar.
I did too. Like Webinars, this guy has some nefarious intentions. He makes a wax crocodile, and then he throws it into a pond where his wife's lover is having a nice bath. And then the wax crocodile comes to life, eats the person and then vanishes. And then the priest comes back and can summon the crocodile from the pond and turn it back into wax.
Yeah. And he does so in the presence of the pharaoh. And then the pharaoh observes this and says, after observing this magic, says, oh, well, you're right. There's the lover right there.
So he turns.
I sentence him to death.
Sorry, we should have said he turns it back into wax, and that what it vomits up the lover.
Right. Yeah, and then the pharaoh says, "Well, there's the lover. Your story checks out. I sentence him to death." And so then the priest here turns the wax crocodile back into a real crocodile. It eats the lover, and this time vanishes for good into the water. So.
That is a great myth. That is awesome.
Yeah, I love it. I mean, you have statues becoming real creatures and then turning back into statues, and it's a fun one. In addition to these stories, though, again, we do find wax amulets, including ankhs, offering tables, winged sun disks, tiets, which are Isis symbols, and collars. Also animals, such as one of a hippo, which it said can be destroyed in order to slaughter an actual hippo.
What?
Yeah.
You can burn the wax hippo to kill the real hippo.
Yeah, so more of this the symbolic magic of burning the likeness in order to harm or destroy the actual thing.
You wonder how ideas like that persisted if they have a guarantee. I feel like some ambiguity had to be built into it, because otherwise people would kind of observe that they were burning wax hippos and not killing their hippo every time.
Yeah. I'm thinking something you would do in addition to taking direct physical action against the hippo.
Yeah. See that. Yeah. Like it increases your chances of defeating the hippo with a spear.
Yeah, there's also a 13th dynasty myth that alleges that the pharaoh Necténebo used rituals entailing little wax ships to secure victories against the Persians.
Oh,
and there's not a lot of additional data there, but I can either imagine it as a ritual that's carried out in addition to military action,
yes.
As a way to sort of bless your military action. Or I couldn't, in the back of my mind, I couldn't help but think, well, maybe this guy just had like wax models of his units and it was like wargaming it out, on the table before him. And perhaps maybe an onlooker thought, hey, he's practicing magic here. Clearly he's using little likenesses of the ships in order to magically secure victory.
Well, there is a lot of ambiguity, as we've been saying, between functional uses and magical uses. And this definitely comes through, as we mentioned earlier, in medicine.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like we said, they do use honey for a lot of medical practices. Honey and beeswax both.
Yeah, apparently there are over 500 documented prescriptions that use honey, and a lot of times it's just about making the thing that you're eating more palatable. You know,
yeah,
it's a spoonful of sugar to make the medicine go down.
That's not to be discounted. I mean, that is legitimate medical technology if it eases the application of a medicine.
Yeah, and then other times it is an active ingredient in the medication.
Yeah, there is one thing I had to relate from the book that talks about how the Ebers papyrus, mm-hmm. this famous papyrus from ancient Egypt, describes several ways of treating constipation, which it calls, quote, to open the belly.
Okay.
Which I don't know. When I picture that, I see what it is described in Jurassic Park that the velociraptor does with its claw, spills your intestines out everywhere.
Yeah.
but no, this is to cure constipation. So one of the cures it offers for constipation is this. You get some milk, you get some honey, and you get notched sycamore figs. Then you boil that mixture down, and then you run it through a strainer, and then you drink this for 4 days.
Okay.
And apparently it worked pretty well at curing constipation, but it worked a little too well, because some patients had their constipation so decisively cured that they ended up with a prolapsed anus.
Oh.
And so what do you do to help this poor patient that now has a prolapsed anus? Well, you mix up a balm of salt, oil, and honey, and then you apply directly to the anus.
Okay.
For another 4 days.
So again, the use of honey.
The honey makes the anus go out. The honey makes the anus come back in.
Okay.
Or maybe it doesn't make it come back in, but maybe just eases some of the discomfort you feel.
And even modern studies have documented the use of honey as a way to treat cuts and burns, to alleviate the symptoms and the pain therein.
Yeah, it has legitimate medical potential.
Yeah, as as Kritsky points out in his book, it has osmotic potential. So it's, you know, it's this viscous substance. Mm-hmm. There's not a lot of liquid in there, so it can actually suck the fluid out of bacteria, and in doing so, lessen bacterial infections.
Yeah. I mean, honey has natural antimicrobial properties.
Yeah.
I think part of this is just due to its pH, right? It has low pH, meaning it's acidic, but it also has other chemical properties.
That's right. Antimicrobial activity in most honeys is due to the enzymatic production of hydrogen peroxide.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So the fizzy stuff.
Yeah. And I mean, additionally, too, you're putting honey on a wound. It maintains a moist wound condition. That high viscosity helps to provide a protective barrier to prevent infection. If your wound is caked in honey, nothing's necessarily going to get through that honey layer on top, as delicious as it may seem. And, you know, in many reports, there are many reports out there of honey being used very effectively as a dressing for wounds, burns, skin ulcers, and inflammations, with the antibacterial properties of honey speeding up the growth of new tissue to heal the wound. Studies have actually found that honey, can reduce healing times in patients suffering mild to moderate burn wounds.
That's cool.
Yeah.
But of course, getting back to the ancient world, the Ebers Papyrus also has some other recommendations
for us.
It does prescribe honey for treating urinary problems. If you pee too much or if it hurts when you do, mixtures containing honey were recommended. I don't know to what extent that actually would have been effective or if the honey was what was responsible for it. But the honey also was used in a mixture of some genuinely gross sounding prophylactic devices for contraception. Other ingredients were things like crocodile feces and sour milk.
Oh.
And essentially it's a female condom made out of the grossest combination of substances you can find, but it included honey. And I know Kritsky points out that it's possible. Some studies have suggested that the sour milk could have actually had, spermicidal properties to it. So this may have been partially effective, but, this is not a recommendation that you try any of these mixtures at home.
Yeah. Do not try this at home. You know, and of course, in talking about all of this too, the placebo effect has to be huge too, because, we've discussed how I think you've brought it up, the something happened scenario, right? You felt something, right? And in this case, it could just be the sweet sensation of tasting honey.
Yeah. I've actually mentioned before, this is something that comes up a lot on another podcast I listen to sometimes called
the Sawbones.
Sawbones. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Where they talk about weird, applications of medicine throughout history. In fact, my wife Rachel told me that they have an episode on honey. I haven't had a chance to listen to it, but we should check that out.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, I'd love to hear it, because I know of a few other uses of honey, in medicine that are kind of strange, but I would love to hear a complete overall, examination of different cultures and their use of honey.
Yeah. And those guys are always pretty funny. So that should be a good one.
Oh, cool. All right, so we have talked about the healing power of honey, the magical use of honey, the beekeeping techniques that the ancient Egyptians seemed to utilize to get the honey and the wax from the bees. And before that, we talked about the way the bees produce honey to begin with and why they evolved into this curious state.
I really am fascinated by the emergence of apiculture as just one incarnation of agriculture and the domestication of animals as a technology in human history, because I think this is often overlooked when thinking about what technology is. I think of technology these days and I just think of electronics.
Yeah.
And I always have to remember to broaden my mind. And if I try to broaden my mind, I go from electronics to other mechanical, inanimate objects that we use as tools to accomplish goals in smart ways. But it really shouldn't even just be inanimate objects, because really the control of other living organisms to accomplish goals should be thought of as a technology. And I think this is one of the most complex and fascinating ones that we have, that we've created a relationship with a symbiotic relationship in nature that already exists between flowers and bees and made it work to our advantage. There's something very beautiful and very weird about that. If you can just step back for a moment and look at this as an alien would, that we keep insects in containers that fertilize the plants that grow all over the earth and make sweet food and medicine for us.
Yeah, it's crazy. And it's, And indeed, it is a true technology. And it's one that, like the pyramids, has stood the test of time. As Zakritsky points out, you can find traditional Egyptian beekeepers to this day that are using some of the same techniques that would have been used in ancient times.
Yeah. And I think this is just one more example of something that I think is sort of a recent theme on this show, something we like to talk about, that, that ancient cultures or cultures that are pre-modern technology, before electronics, before steam-powered industry or anything like that, were not stupid. I think it's easy for people to think, oh, they didn't have any of the technology we have. They must have been dumb. Mm-hmm. They weren't at all. They were amazingly clever. I think in many ways probably more clever than us, because they didn't have as much easy they didn't have an easy foothold like we did to make new advances. So they were working with what they had, and when you see the innovations they came up with, it's astounding.
Indeed.
Mother's Day is coming, and Mom doesn't want flowers. She wants a cocktail. Here's a hint. Get Mom Bartesian. It's the countertop cocktail maker that creates your choice of over 60 premium cocktails in less than 30 seconds, each at the touch of a button. Flowers die. Happy hour comes back every day. So get Mom the machine that makes amazing cocktails with real fruit juices and craft bitters. Best of all, get $50 off a Bartesian premium cocktail maker with the purchase of one pack of cocktail capsules. So, instead of getting Mom a reason to fill a flower vase with water, get Mom the easiest, fastest way to fill her glass with the floral notes of gin. The best cocktails are premium cocktails, and the best day to get it for Mom is Mother's Day, because you can get $50 off now for a limited time. Visit bartesian.com/mother to get the best premium cocktail maker for Mom at the best price for you. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
Western nations like the U.S. and Europe.
Mexico will likely have its first female president.
And then you have China.
And help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters.
He'll get his yo-yos to Europe in time. But the longer this drags on, the more worry he's getting.
They knew that they needed to do this as fast as they possibly could to get a drug on the market as fast as they could.
I'm David Gura.
I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen. We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets.
Basically, everyone was expecting, if not a calamity, certainly a recession.
But the problem is that paperwork, as our reporting showed, is fake.
As someone who's covering the market, I'm often very worried about an imminent collapse. So I'm thinking about it quite often.
Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. It is 2024, and we're going to get through this together, folks. My campaign promise to all of you here on Next Question, it's going to be a good time the whole time, we hope. I have some big news to share with you on our season premiere featuring Kris Jenner, who's got some words of wisdom for me on being a good grandmother, or in her case, a good lovey.
You know, you start thinking of what you want your grandmother name to be. Like, are they going to call me grandma like I called my grandmother? So I got to choose my name, which is now Lovey.
I'll also be joined by Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, to name a few. So come on in and take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood.
I loved it. Your energy and joy.
I'm squeezing every minute I can for you out of this season of Next Question. Last question, I promise. You have to go, I have to go. But it's been so fun, and I can't wait for you to hear it. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
So, hey, let's go ahead and get Mr. Kritsky on the phone here, and we will ask him just a few follow-up questions about his book, The Tears of Rey. All right, Professor Kritsky, thank you for joining us here on the podcast to discuss your excellent book, The Tears of Rey, Beekeeping in Ancient Egypt.
Yeah, I think Robert and I both really enjoyed this book, so thank you for writing it, in addition to thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you very much. It's great to be here.
So just to kick things off, how did you first become interested in ancient Egyptian beekeeping?
Oh, I've been a frustrated historian for many, many years. And my interest in Egyptology and insects all sort of happened about the same time in my early teen years living in Miami, Florida. And I remember walking home and seeing a wild nest of a honeycomb that had fallen on the ground. And I collected out all the bees and put them in I was a nerd. I put them in test tubes and took them up into my room and watched them develop and ended up taking them to the school. And they had them on display for several days. And that got my interest in honeybees. My interest in Egyptology happened a few weeks later. I was going to a parochial institution that was very creationist in its orientation. And they started talking about Noah's flood and Usher's chronology and said that the flood occurred in 2348 BC. And that seemed kind of interesting to me because I'd seen dates that pertained to Egyptology that seemed older. So I went and started reading books on ancient Egypt and found that the pyramids were built 500 years before the flood. And it was a real enlightening experience. Am I the only one that's seeing this? You know?
Must have built them very sturdy.
Oh, that's right. The flood that created that carved out the Grand Canyon didn't destroy the pyramids. Come on. So anyway, that really got me going. And but I also got fascinated with Egyptology at that time. And even while I was working on my PhD in entomology, I remember that was when the King Tut exhibit was touring for the first time in the late 70s, and going to the Egyptology section at the University of Illinois Library and just sitting on the floor and pulling off every volume, one after the other, looking for any kind of insect association and insect reference. And that's how it started, wanting to sort of annoy my high school teachers and then getting caught up in the King Tut craze. Yeah, that was when Steve Martin did that wonderful song on Saturday Night Live, so it was a way to get caught up in that as well.
So, Dr. Kritsky, what would you say about how the ancient Egyptian treatment of beekeeping, the apiculture technology, what does that reveal about the ancient Egyptian culture? What does their technology say about who these people were and what they believed?
Well, the aspect, of course, the title of the book is The Tears of Rey, and there is a papyrus from 300 BCE, which gives the whole story about what the Egyptians thought bees were about, and that the statement that's in this papyrus that wrote that the god Rey wept and the tears from his eyes fell on the ground and turned into a bee. And the bee made his honeycomb and busied himself with the flowers of every plant. And so wax was made and also honey out of the tears of Rey. And so for the Egyptians, honey was a gift of the sun god. And that made it very, very important to them. Not only was it an important commodity as a sweetener, it was used in medicine, it was used the wax was very important in medicine as well, along with honey, but also as a magical substance. All of this came from these insects that were essentially the manifestation of the god's tears. And so that made honey quite valuable from a theological perspective, but also from a biological perspective as well. And even in their temples, the Sun Temple, for example, from the 5th dynasty of Nowasrayani, there's this wonderful relief that shows beekeeping. And so here's something that was, I've been to a lot of cathedrals and temples and churches around the world, and I've not seen displays about beekeeping in there. So that puts it in a whole different perspective.
Now, in your research, am I correct in reading that you at one point became locked inside of a tomb?
Yes, that happened. That was I was a Fulbright scholar to Egypt in the early 80s, and I was teaching in Minya University, about 150 miles south of Cairo. And as part of my research, I was just visiting archaeological sites to find any kind of insect carving, any references to insects and what have you. Visited 94 archaeological sites. And I was getting so well known in the area that I was even asked by members of the Fulbright Commission if I would meet guests and take them on tours. And in one instance was the American ambassador to Egypt. He and his wife and their son came down to Minya for a tour of the antiquities. And of course, His Excellency received a government escort everywhere he was going, and the ambassador's son and I went off on our own. And while we were down in an underground necropolis, a sandstorm blew up, and they grabbed the ambassador and his wife and escorted them to the rest house, and we weren't there. And I was told later that he looked around and said, "Where's my son?" And this military official responded, "He is safe, Your Excellency. He is locked in the tomb."
Oh, wow.
And so, of course, we had two guards with us. We weren't in any real danger, and it wasn't like it was like airtight. We were going to suffocate because you actually see through cracks in the door. So his son and I started exploring on our own while we were waiting. We were in there about 45 minutes and went down one shaft and found a small coffin that would have held a mummified ibis bird. We found a crocodile skull. There was mummy linen everywhere because this was an important underground animal necropolis. So it was quite an exciting time. It's one of those few things that I never expected to do, and it's something that doesn't happen to a lot of people.
You know, the mummified animals you mentioned, that relates back to something I know you mentioned in the book, but I didn't have a time to look up on the side. Was you mentioned the Crocodilopolis, which sounded fascinating to me. What's the deal with that?
Crocodilopolis, that was a city that was prominent during the Ptolemaic period, later in ancient Egypt, they worshipped the crocodile god was the god Sobek, and so Crocodilopolis was associated with that deity. And the reference in the book talked about feeding crocodiles a food that was also laced with honey.
Oh, yeah. So one of the things that you point out in the book, and I noticed even before you pointed it out in several of the different artworks and carvings, is the variable number of legs in the depictions of bees. Like sometimes you would see with apparently three legs, which sort of makes sense because it seems like maybe if you're looking from one side, each leg could represent a pair. But then other times you'd see what looked to me like four legs or maybe five legs, depending on how you interpreted one little strand coming out the back of the bee. And this rang a bell in my mind, and I remembered that there is a passage in the book of Leviticus, in Leviticus 11, that talks about winged insects with four legs. And I thought that was a kind of strange coincidence. Now, there are obviously a lot of ways you might explain a glyph of a bee or an illustration of a bee in the ancient world having a different number of legs. But do you think this was a widespread belief in the ancient Near East that there were insects with four legs, or is this just conservation of detail?
Well, in the case of the Egyptian honeybee, the most exact carvings show the bee having four legs oriented forward, and then the hind leg is actually superimposed on the abdomen. And in some instances, that wasn't drawn in or was very lightly carved in, so it doesn't stand out because it's actually almost superimposed on the abdomen itself. And on almost all cases, you're going to find evidence that they probably had all six legs, but they might not have carved the hind leg as detailed enough because of the abdominal structure. Carving that honeybee hieroglyph was quite variable. I have a chapter in the book about how they would go about doing this. And it was like doing handwriting analysis, if you're going to do forensic handwriting analysis for forgery or what have you. And found that were certain patterns that were consistent with certain bees in certain places of temples, for example. But in general, unless if it's a very careful carving, it always has evidence of the four legs forward and then the hind leg superimposed on it, but you wouldn't see the other leg on the other side of the abdomen in that case. So I think you're looking at mostly not necessarily being careful for the eye of detail, but in some cases these details might have slowly given away during time through time.
Interesting.
So a question. This is something that maybe didn't come up as much in the book, but it kind of relates to some previous episodes that we've done with the podcast that deal with Egyptology and animals. Did the ancient Egyptians ever use bees as a weapon in any sense?
I didn't run across any example of honeybees being used as a weapon, like you'd see, for example, some of the medieval illuminated manuscripts, and some of the references talk about skep straw beehives being thrown over castle walls, for example, to break up a siege and things like that. So I did not find any evidence of bees being used as a weapon per se. The difference was in the type of hives Egyptians were using. They were clay tubes. They would not stand to a lot of trauma, if you will. They had fewer bees in each one than we would have in our typical modern box hive, probably 5,000-7,000 bees as opposed to, you know, 35,000 to 45,000, 50,000 bees in a tall multi-store, multi-boxed Langstroth hive.
Cool. And so I've got a couple of other ideas. I want to see what you think about the relationship between humans and bees and bee evolution. So one of the first things I started thinking about in this book is that beekeeping seems interesting to me in that it might be unique. And I wonder if you can think of any other examples in that it seems like a truly three-way symbiotic relationship between the plants that are pollinated, the bees that produce the honey, and then the human beekeepers. And I was trying to think of another relationship that's equally symbiotic three ways, and I couldn't quite. But I wondered if you had any insight on that.
With regard to the bees, I think humans were probably interacting with honeybees long before we became Homo sapiens.
Huh.
We know now that, for example, chimpanzees will take sticks and fashion them in different thicknesses, for example, to tear into a wild honeybee nest. And they'll even carry these sticks around with them. So they, if the chimpanzees were doing that, it's quite likely that the hominins, our ancestors, were probably doing this as well, going back several million years. So this association with bees is very ancient in our species, and probably definitely predates modern humans. So in that case, since honeybees, they're not truly beekeeping, they're robbing.
Right.
But there is a relationship that they're actually going to be taking advantage of the golden sweet windfall of a bee's nest. And that was probably how our beekeeping originated. There are symbiotic relationships that might involve up to three organisms, but don't necessarily involve humans. I'm trying to think. So I'm thinking of things like the fig wasps, and things like that. That you'd see a very specialized relationship between the figs, humans, and the wasps. And in those cases, now in the case of Egypt, they didn't have the fig wasps, so they were actually scarifying the fruit to make it ripen, but. And of course, that would be a three-way example as well.
Excellent. Yeah, I didn't even think about the fig wasps, but that's a tremendous example.
That is a great question. I like that's coming from the side that I hadn't even thought about before. My mind is really clicking on that one.
well, that leads into the next question I wanted to ask, which is about the evolutionary relationship we see with other domesticated animals that humans use for their agriculture for companionship. So we've got dogs, we've got cattle, we've got all kinds of, you know, draft animals, farm animals that in many ways have very much diverged evolutionarily from their wild ancestors. And I wonder if we see anything like that with domesticated bees, or if we ever will in the future. Is it because we've had a domestication relationship with bees for less time if we don't see that?
I think there's no question that we've had an impact on honeybee evolution. Case in point, in Europe during the last 1500 years, when we kept bees in straw and wicker skep hives, the basket hives, it was very common in the earlier centuries when you harvested the honey, the beekeeper would walk around, lift the skep, and if it was really heavy, that'd be the one that they would harvest. And how they would harvest it, they would dig a pit in the ground, fill it with sulfur and brimstone, what have you, and start a fire and literally knock all the bees into the fire.
Whoa.
Now what they're doing is taking their best producing bees and killing them.
Hmm.
Darwin has something to say about that. And what we're seeing is this, we have for centuries slowly been killing large numbers of very good producing colonies. And then we tried to, some of the bees, eventually we got to the point where they could drive the bees out of these wicker basket hives. They would take the skep hive, put it in the full skep, put it upside down in a pail, and then have an empty skep next to it, and using pieces of board, nail the sort of hold that up, empty skep in place, and then they'd bang the daylights out of the side of that pail, and the bees would walk out of the full skep up into the empty skep, and they could drive the bees from one hive to the next.
Huh, that is
so that stopped. That we started seeing that in good numbers in the late 1800s, and quite common during the 19th century. But we, for many, many years, had been, you know, going out and selectively killing good producing bees. And a colleague of mine, Steve Shepard, up at Washington State University, he has been looking at the diversity of honeybees and has found that all the bees in the United States are, all of our queens are related to a small number of queens. It's fewer than 1,000.
Huh.
And so we have dramatically reduced the genetic diversity of bees over the years as beekeepers. That may be contributing to some of the problems that we are having. And there's a concerted effort now. Steve is doing this and others to go out all over the world and try to improve the genetic diversity by getting collecting drones and getting semen samples to bring back for crosses.
Well, that's really fascinating. So that makes me wonder, do we already have, or do you ever think we will have, domesticated bees that are as different from the wild original honeybee as, say, a chihuahua is from the gray wolf?
Well, we have several strains or varieties now. And they're all Apis mellifera, but they're subspecies. They all, from what we can tell, they all evolved on their own. And, you know, for example, the Italian strain came from the Alps area, North Italy, and what have you. There has been attempts. Brother Adam was a beekeeper who was trying to selectively breed bees that would mature a little faster to help reduce its parasite load, for example. So there are efforts to do things like that. I've not seen any real, you know, overall success that would say that it's come to fruition yet. But it is quite conceivable that we could modify bees through selective breeding to be something different.
Interesting. Well, Robert, did you have something else?
No, I believe that's a great place to leave off. I just want to thank you again, Professor Kritsky, for taking the time to chat with us, and encourage all of our listeners, whether you're interested in history or insects, if it's the ancient Egyptian angle or the beekeeping angle that brings you in, like, this is just a tremendous and accessible read on both topics.
It's a shameless plug, I will say my previous book with Oxford was The Quest for the Perfect Hive, which is the history of the modern beehive.
Oh, excellent.
And how we got from these tube hives from the Egyptians up to the through basket hives into those white boxes that we see out in fields.
Now, can you tell us what will the hives of the future look like?
Oh, wow. That's one of the themes behind my the book, The Quest for the Perfect Hive, is one of the things that's happened is we've stopped inventing. It's beginning to come back a little bit, but during the late 19th century into the 20th century, beekeepers were spending a lot of money to buy equipment that was interchangeable, and they were buying extractors, and it's rather expensive to actually retool an entire honeybee operation. And so if you went and found a beekeeping supply catalog from the 1920s, it would look just like our catalogs today in some cases.
Wow.
Except they wouldn't have styrofoam hives. And so here we have these pre-Depression era bees living in hives that were invented back in the 1920s. And we have their honeybee genome. And so, you know, my question always is, have we found the perfect hive?
Huh.
And since the book's come out, we're now seeing a lot of people invest exploring new hives. There's a couple that are really quite intriguing. The Omelette Hive out of England, which is a wonderful hive for, it's expensive, but it's a wonderful hive for the backyard beekeeper. We, of course, you might have recently heard about the flow hive. That's this hive that you can automatically extract the honey from the hive through hoses. And that's something that's new. I believe there's a Kickstarter campaign to help fund that. There's a lot of interest in trying to improve beekeeping operations to encourage more people to keep bees, even if they don't want to collect the honey, but just keep the pollinators around.
Oh, man, the beehive with the hoses, that sounds like an H.R. Giger kind of concept.
you should take a look at it. They are actually able to split the honeycomb, and then the honey then flows out through hoses into containers, so they don't have to take the frames out for extracting.
Wow, well, that's fascinating. Well, I guess we should wrap it up unless there's anything else you feel like you would like to say, but I really appreciate you talking to us.
I thoroughly enjoyed it. Thank you for having me.
All right, so there you have it. That book, again, is The Tears of Ray, Beekeeping in Ancient Egypt by Gene Kritsky, and that is Ray, spelled R-E. You can find that. It's available in both physical and digital copies right now, and we'll include a link to it on the landing page for this episode at stufftoblowyourmind.com.
And if you want to get in touch with us about this episode or any recent episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, you can always email us at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
It's been almost 3,000 years, and Greek mythology has proved that it is not going anywhere. But it can be difficult to find entertaining and engaging retellings of these myths that aren't fictionalized. Lucky for you, I'm here. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the Greek mythology and ancient history podcast of your dreams. I dive into the convoluted and confusing ancient sources so you don't have to. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.